Alex Hutchinson is a contributing editor at Outside Magazine, a former Canadian national team long-distance runner, and the author of Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. This is Alex Hutchinson. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right, I'm here with Alex Hutchinson. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Duncan. It's great to have a chance to chat.
So I was looking at your bio, and right off the bat, before we get into the book Endure, you started off as a physicist. You got your PhD in physics at Cambridge. Then you went on to run for the Canadian national team. Now you're a writer. How did all of this happen? This seems like a very unusual biography.
Yeah. Well, I certainly didn't sort of plan it out that way coming out of high school. I didn't have a sort of 15-year plan where like, yeah, I'm going to waste the next decade doing things, something that I'm never going to use again. No, that's not actually how I look back at my time right. in physics. But yeah, I didn't, you know, the truth is like a lot of people, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And in a sense, my thinking with physics at the time was, first of all, I found it interesting. I mean, I still do. Physics is interesting. But I also thought, if I don't know what I want to do, and this is some advice, I can't even remember who gave me this advice, but someone gave me this advice, you know, as I was trying to figure out in my last year of high school what I wanted to do. They said, if you don't know what you want to do, do something hard because, you know, you'll show that you'll learn problem solving ability and you'll show that your capabilities, and it's kind of a one way street. You can't study, I don't know, I don't want to be dismissive of anything, but you right. can't study something easy and then say, oh, you know what, now I'm going to go do, you know, subatomic physics. But you can study physics and then decide to do something else. So physics was something that challenged me intellectually and was fun, but just never, and I gave it a good shot. Like I gave it time trying to see if it would kind of fire my passions and get me interested in a career in it. And I worked both, you know, as a grad student and then as a postdoc with people who were smart and interesting and I could tell they had more of a passion for the work than I did. One of the things that I remember is, you know, sometimes as a postdoc working very long hours and you'd be in the lab till 10 at night and you'd come in the next morning. And I remember at one point, one of my colleagues on one of those mornings asked me, hey, did you read that such and such an article on physics today? And I remember just thinking like, I spent 14 hours in the lab yesterday and I'm back here first thing in the morning. The last thing I was going to do when I went home last night was to read physics today. Like I had enough of physics, but for those guys, they loved the physics so much that they would do it all day and then go home and read about it. And yeah. So that was a inspiration for me to say, figure out what's going to make me excited. What's going to be the thing that I can spend all day working on it. And then, you know, I'm going to be after dinner wanting to do more of the same area, because then I'll have a lot more fun, you know, pursuing a passion.
Well, I mean, you gave it a hell of a shot because not only did you study it as an undergrad, you went on to get your PhD and postdoc work. When did you in that period start running seriously?
Yes. I mean, in a sense, yeah, running, I started running seriously in high school and I was a promising high schooler. And then I had mononucleosis in my last year of high school. And my early college years, I was not competing as well as I thought I could. And then sort of things came together in my last couple of years of undergrad. And I made my first national team in my last year of undergrad. And that sort of fired me up because then I thought I sort of felt like maybe I have a chance to, you know, get to the Olympic level. So the truth is, and you know, these things are all connected because ultimately, while I was doing my PhD and postdoc, if you'd asked me at any point then what the most important thing in my life was, it was running and it was trying to make the Olympics. And, you know, you only have so much passion to go around. So I do look back and wonder that, you know, maybe one of the reasons physics didn't quite click for me is that I had an obsession at the time with running. And I still, you know, I still find running very interesting and, you know, that's, it still underlies a lot of what I do today. But, in my, you know, when I was 25, if there was multiple things going on in my day, if there was like, I had important work commitments and I had an important track workout and I had family stuff and friend stuff and social obligations, you know, the way I put my day together is that the workout came first and then everything else had to fit around that. Like if something had to give, it was never the workout that was like, I don't have time to do my workout today. It's like, I don't have time to be a good friend, or I don't have time to talk to other people. I don't have time to finish the work I was supposed to do. Those would all be choices I would have made before giving up my workout. So running was a huge part of my life, a bigger part of my life than physics. And I wonder if I, let's say I'd hurt my knee when I was 18 and ended my running career.
Right.
Maybe I would have channeled that passion into physics and I'd be sitting here today as a physicist. I don't know, but the result was, and so in the end, I sort of signed off my really serious running career when I was 28. I got a stress fracture in my back a few months before the 2004 Olympic trials. And it was kind of the final straws, like, okay, I'm not going to make it this year, and I'm probably not going to make it next time. And coinciding with that, I literally started, I left my physics postdoc and started journalism school a couple months after that Olympic trials. So it was kind of new start where now running is no longer the most important thing in my life, and I'm starting a whole new career. And so it felt really great, and it was really exciting and clicked, but maybe it's a little bit because I was finally open to a new passion, that the competitive running part of my life was finally sort of leaving room for something else.
Well, you know, what's interesting is I had talked to an Olympic silver medalist who did the aerial skiing, and he was on the Australian skiing team. And, when I talked to him, I was, in awe of the fact that this guy won, an Olympic medal. But the way he described it was basically his life did not change that much. And he's like, yeah, people don't really care that much about aerial skiing. Do you ever, I don't want to say there's a tone of regret in your voice, but the idea that you could have made the Olympics, do you think your life would have really been that much different? I mean, it would have on paper, but materially.
No, yeah, that's a great point. And this is something I think about a lot because right now I'm, not to answer this in a roundabout way, but right now I'm 44 years old. I've had a book that, I've written a few books and the last one did well. And so it's sort of like, I have a lot of decisions right now, but what do I want to do with the rest of my life? How much of my life do I want to devote to climbing the ladder, trying to make sure my next book, it does better than this one, versus I have two young kids. My kids are 4 and 6, and there's lots of things that I love doing. How much time do I want to spend backpacking and canoeing and playing pickup basketball on Friday nights and stuff like that? Not that I can do that these days with coronavirus, but anyway, right. These are decisions we all face, right? Like what is important in life? And I feel like I got some really, really, really important insights from my running career. Because as I said, I started out as a very promising high schooler. Then I had some low times and through those times when I was struggling, I thought what I really, really wanted most in life was to make a national team. Like I just imagined the idea of, as I'm Canadian, so putting the maple leaf singlet on my chest and going to some international competition, to a world championships or something like that, or better yet, the Olympics, and competing there, like much less, winning the Olympics or setting a world record, but being on a national team was like the be all and end all for me. And I was lucky enough that dream came true when I was 21. I made a national team, and it was like the best 10 minutes of my life when I realized that I had made the team. And then it was amazing how quickly, and I could see it happening, I could feel it happening. It was amazing how quickly the focus shifted to, okay, now I'm on the national team. I don't want to make a fool of myself. I don't want to get knocked out in the heats. I want to make the semifinals. I want to make the finals. And then it was like, well, this national team that I've made is relatively minor. It was the World University Games. I'd like to make a more prestigious one. I'd like to make the Pan Am Games or the Commonwealth Games or the World Championships. And there were a lot, running is a very it's a very objective pastime.
Right.
Times are very clear. You set goals and you you achieve them. It's not like I like other sports, but it's in basketball, you can be like, yeah, I was really, really good. It's just, I didn't get the ball enough, or, people didn't appreciate what an amazing defensive player I was. But it's like, no, running, you either run the time or you don't. And it's very objective. And I didn't achieve all my goals, but I achieved enough of them to come to the realization that whatever goal I achieved, it would feel good. It was great. And then I would immediately be looking towards the next goal. And I've thought about that a lot in my career too, trying to remind myself that, some things have happened in my journalistic career that have been dreams come true. Like my book made the New York Times bestseller list. That was like something that was on a lifetime achievement list for me. And it's done, and it's like, it was great, and I enjoyed it. But then immediately it's like, well, I have friends who've written books that weren't on like the niche list. They were on the main list, or that they were number one.
Oh my God.
And it's like, and you just realize that there's this, whatever, the hungry ghost or whatever in Buddhism, right, or whatever it is. It's like, it's always possible to want more. And whether you, like the person you spoke to, the Olympic silver medalist, that guy's like, I could have won gold, or I could have been in a sport that people actually care about, or you know, whatever. I've really, you know, it's people, lots of, anyway, I think people realize this, and I got a really early lesson in it from running, is that even when your dreams come true, you just make new dreams. And so the important thing is to make, and it's such a cliche to say it, but is to make sure you're enjoying chasing those dreams, because getting it is never going to turn off the voices inside you.
That, hearing you describe that makes why you wrote a book about the limits of human performance, it makes a lot more sense, I suppose. But it is something I like to ask authors when they come on. This book, Endure, why? There are other books out there about, you know, mind over matter and things like that. And obviously your book did really well. But why did you decide to write this book?
Yeah, there's a lot of different reasons. One of which is, you know, I have a mortgage and I wanted to, seriously. You described the book as a sort of mind over matter type book. And that's what it has in a way has ended up being. We can get into the nuances of that. It didn't start out that way really. This is connected to what we were just talking about. The idea of like, is there some ultimate achievement? It's like, if you make the Olympics, does that mean you achieved everything you wanted and you're satisfied? Well, for that to be true, there has to be a kind of, in just speaking in running, but you can take this as a metaphor for life, I think, in running, to have this idea that there's an ultimate achievement, that you fulfill all your goals, there has to be a certain limit that you're capable of. So this idea that's implicit in chasing goals, like running goals, that my body is capable of X, and I just want to get fit enough and have a good enough race that I achieve X. But what is X? Like, how do we know what the limit is? If I go out and run a race tomorrow, I'll run some time. How do I know whether that's everything I was capable of, or whether I'm actually, you know, way far away from my actual limits?
Right.
And so that's a question that you sort of face implicitly when you're running, and something that I always wondered about. And I initially started out as a freelance journalist in about 2006. And because I had a science background and a running background, I started writing about the science of endurance, the science of limits. And to me, it was a very much a sort of plumbing problem, a very mathematical problem. Let's understand, you know, how much oxygen can the heart pump to the muscles? How much, what's the role of lactic acid? Understanding the physiological limits. And it was only gradually that I started to realize, yeah, you know, you can't really answer this question without also considering the role of the brain. And it turned out there's actually, at that, this is 10, 15 years ago, that was a time when there was this huge rush or upsurge of research and controversy trying to understand, how can we calculate the limits of a human? If, you know, how do we, can we incorporate the brains? Because it's not just, we're not just machines. We are controlled by the brain. And so that's where that journey started. And it ended up being a much more focused on the role of the mind, because that turned out to be where the interesting research was. But the initial question was just like, hey, if I run a race, how do I know if I got everything out of myself?
Well, it's fascinating, because there are very few things in the external world where what it is depends on what your perception of it is. In other words, what your limits are in large part depends on what your perception of your limits are. And you begin the book talking about the time you broke your 4-minute mile. Can you go into a little bit about why you felt like that was an important anecdote to relate?
Yeah, for sure. And I'll just clarify, for the sake of complete transparency, I never ran a 4-minute mile. It was a 4-minute 1500 meter race,
which is
a little bit shorter than a mile. A mile is 1609 meters, and by the end of the career, but by the end of my career, my best 1500 time is equivalent to a mile in about 4.02 or something like that. So, according to the official,
still impressive. I love the fact that you have to clarify though.
yeah. But it's also the kind of thing that keeps me awake at night. It's like, man, 0.02 seconds. If you want to talk about regrets, that's number one there that got a 4 minute mile, sub 4 minute mile. But anyway, that anecdote is really formative. And I think it sort of, seeded the interest that led to the book. And it basically to try and keep it somewhat concise, I was trying to break 4 minutes 1500. I'd been trying for like 3 or 4 years and I kept running 4:01, 4:02. I was stuck at this threshold. So going back to this idea of limits, I really felt like I was at the limit of what my body could do. I knew I could run 3:59, but it was clear I'd been training for 3 or 4 years and running these times, you know, there wasn't going to be a whole lot more in the tank. And what ended up happening, in short, is when you run a track race, you have the guy at the finish line will call out your splits as you run past your intermediate time, so you have a sense of how fast you're running. And basically, this guy was calling out the wrong times. He missed the he must have missed the start and not started his watch when the gun fired, because he was calling out times that were about 3 seconds faster than I was actually running. And so I had this bizarre disconnect between feeling like I was running at a nice relaxed pace, but according to the splits, I was actually running an amazingly fast time. So he basically tricked me into thinking I was having the most amazing day of my life.
Yeah.
And as a result, I was like, this is it. Like, don't waste it. Just go, you were obviously having a wonderful day. And I ended up running 3:52 that day. So it was like a 9 second personal best after 3 or 4 years of complete, being at a barrier. And then the sort of even weirder thing is, and I found out afterwards that the splits had been wrong and I'd been tricked. But then in my next race, I ran 3:49. And then after that, I ran 3:44 in the race after that. So I had this, all of a sudden, an unlocking of this physical potential that, obviously it had been there for, it was there for the taking, but I'd been convinced that I was a 4 minute guy trying to go 3:59. And then suddenly I was running 3:44 within the space of three races. And so trying to understand that, I didn't understand it. I couldn't understand it. I'm not, I still, even 20 years later, I don't fully understand how that happened, but that sort of raised the questions for me of like, okay, how can that happen? And what happened to me that sequence of races is unusual. That, most people don't improve 17 seconds in three races, but almost everyone you talk to who races, whether it's, in running or triathlon or cycling, will have some sort of analogous experience. So much faster than the As there was a interview with an Olympic runner named Ian Dobson, where he had this quote that really stuck with me, where he's like, he was talking about his frustrations after making the Olympics in 2008, and then how he was struggling to make it in 2012. He's like, it should be mathematical. You should be able to look at your training or look at your VO2 max or look at some sort of objective data and calculate what your limits are, but it never works that way. There's always surprises.
It is pretty amazing, because you also kind of use that as a jumping off point for the 4 minute mile being broken. And then after it was broken, just hordes of people, I shouldn't say hordes, but 100+ people started breaking the 4 minute mile. Do you have any added insight into that now of why that is? It's so unusual.
Yeah. And I think like so many things, it's not just one thing. It's not like, well, this is why people run the 4 minute mile now. There were a lot of things going on. Like, the first 4 minute mile was 1954. So that's, 9 years after World War II ended, but really only a few years after the world was starting to, food shortages, rationing was still existed in most countries. So there was a time when now finally there was starting to be a little more time and energy to devote to that were helping, and training knowledge was advancing. People were getting a better understanding you know, How to Train. Roger Bannister, who ran the first 4 minute mile, you read his autobiography, and it's like, when he started running in the late 40s, like the captain of the Oxford cross country team would stop to smoke a cigarette after every lap of their cross country races or whatever. So it's like, yeah. You know, there were a lot of things that were helping people get faster and faster. But to me, there's also a clear, and it's become a metaphor of like, once one person does it, other people realize they can do it, and they train, they set their goals, and they train in a way that allows them to do it. And the classic example is the second man to run a 4 minute mile, John Landy. He had run 4:02 or better 6 times before Bannister broke the 4 minute mile. And then as soon as Bannister broke it, 3 weeks later, he ran 3:57. And it's like, all of a sudden it became possible, and immediately he was able to do it. So, you kind of want to steer or be cautious about this sort of oversimplified narrative where it's like, as soon as someone did it, a billion other people could do it easily. Sure. It didn't become easy, and there are a lot of the other things that helped. But we see that in the last couple of years, there's been this chase for a sub 2 hour marathon, and Eliud Kipchoge, a Kenyan runner, last fall ran 1:59:40 under very artificial conditions, and especially like not in a normal marathon race. And so it's going to be an interesting sort of test of that idea over the next few years to see, you know, if and when marathons coming back, come back to normal with the coronavirus. Does the fact that one person was able to do it, is that going to help other people go under? Or is it going to turn out that this was a once in a generation thing and nobody else is going to run a sub 2 hour marathon for another 30 years or whatever?
Well, that's what I was going to lead into, because you also mentioned in the book that there were, biophysicists who computed, VO2 max and all these other factors into an equation. And I believe they demonstrated something like, a possible physical limit for running a marathon is something like an hour and 57 minutes. And furthermore, they tried to predict like when this would happen. And someone said, 2040 or like 2050. Obviously it happened much sooner. Why do you think, and Nike was played a role in this endeavor, why do you think this happened so much sooner than people predicted?
Yeah. So again, here I have to sort of make an admission, which is that I was one of the pundits who I did a big feature on the prospects for a 2 hour marathon back in about 2014 for Runner's World. I did a 10 page analysis, and plotting a bunch of data, talking to experts, looking at trends. And my prediction at the end of the article was 2075. So that is a prediction that did not age well. So what changed? I mean, there's some fundamental sort of just like, there's some really good runners out there right now. And there's in particular, the guy who did it, Eliud Kipchoge is, I would say he has a pretty good claim to having emerged as the greatest marathoner ever. Although he just lost the London Marathon, and it was his first loss in 7 years. He lost it yesterday. But also there's other things that happened too. The goalposts have changed a little bit. Most notably, in 2016, Nike introduced a new kind of shoe that has a stiff carbon fiber plate embedded in the midsole. And it turns out that that probably makes a couple minutes difference to a marathoner. It's a major, the shoes are much more efficient. They allow you to recapture more of the energy that you're spending with each stride. There's also, when Kipchoge ran his sub 2 hour marathon, he did it on a special course in Vienna, which was, instead of, most marathons are held in big cities, New York, Boston, Chicago, London, Berlin. Some courses are faster than others. Boston has a bunch of hills. New York has a bunch of hills. Chicago's fast. Berlin is fast. London is fast. But Vienna was the fastest possible because they did it on a specialized loop where it, basically perfectly flat. They also used pacemakers. They basically had a it's kind of like a cycling style peloton with, six or seven runners blocking the air, blocking wind for Eliud Kipchoge. And crucially, what one of the things they did is they didn't, you know, you can't, it's hard to find someone to pace a 2-hour marathon because nobody can run a 2-hour marathon. And so that creates a fundamental limit when you're trying to set a world record. But they were like, okay, well, you know what? We'll just let runners, we'll have fresh pacemakers coming in partway through the race. And that's actually not allowed for world record purposes. And that's why Kipchoge's sub 2-hour marathon is not considered a world record. Because he had fresh pacemakers. But anyway, all of these things shave off a few seconds here and there. So fundamentally, you know, maybe his 159.40 is actually equivalent to a 202 or something in a regular marathon. I still wouldn't have predicted that it would happen. So there's still, you know, there is this sort of human attraction to arbitrary round number barriers that focuses the mind, and it can serve and it can cut both ways, right? Like it did for John Landy with the 4-minute mile, trying to get under a barrier that you believe is impossible. That barrier can become real, and it can sort of suppress your performances in a way or, you know, kind of paralyze you. But it can also attract you to give your you know, for a different runner, and if you're in a different mindset, trying to get under a given barrier can be a really powerful motivator. And there's some fascinating data. So we're not just talking about people who set world records. There was an analysis by some economists, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, they collected from the services that do timing for major marathons. They had data from about 9 million marathoners, if I remember correctly. And they analyzed the distribution of finishing times. And you get a fairly characteristic curve. There's a lot of people, you know, around 4 hours or 3:30. There's not many people running 2:20, and there's not many people running 6 hours. So you have a nice, not quite a bell-shaped curve, but a smooth curve. But there's little spikes. And so if you look at, let's say, the 3-hour mark, there's way more people running 2:59 than you'd expect. There's a huge spike. And then there's way fewer people than you'd expect running between 3 hours and 3:01. And so clearly, everyone's running their time, but the people who have the chance of getting underneath a significant barrier, like let's say 3 hours, all of a sudden they get close. They get into the last mile. They realize it's possible, and they find that, oh, actually I do have more energy than I realized. I thought I was going as hard as I can, but now that you tell me I have a chance of breaking three, I'm gonna dig a little deeper and push a little harder. And so if you look at this curve, you find that these spikes at, you know, at 2:30, at 3, at 3:30, at 4, at 4:30, at 5, you find them even on every 10-minute interval, 3, 3:10, 3:20, 3:30, 3:40. So, I mean, and these barriers have no physiological meaning, right? Like an arbitrary number of minutes and seconds over an arbitrary distance, 26.2 miles. But we impose the meaning, and then once we grant power to those numbers, it creates our limits for us, or it affects whether, you know, how hard we're able to push ourselves.
Wow. I mean, I guess that makes sense, because I've only run a couple marathons, but the second time I did it, that was my goal. Was, okay, 4 hours. That's an arbitrary distinction. Let's see if I can get under that. But it is, you know, totally made up. And it speaks to, I guess, the power of belief that you see. I mean, one of the reasons I thought your book was fascinating is because it could potentially apply to a lot of different things besides just running. I mean, it kind of explains in some ways like the placebo effect, or the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous is apparently the treatment method is not on its own significantly better than any other addiction treatment. It's the fact that people go in with this powerful belief that it's going to work that makes it, you know, somehow work. Sorry, you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that's a really good and interesting and deep point, because it's something that I think it was a bit of a journey for me, because 10 years ago, like let's say when I was starting the process of writing this book, and I was, my day-to-day job was as a science journalist writing mostly about sports science. And I viewed myself as I still do, but I very much viewed myself then as a sort of debunker of crap, right? of mistaken beliefs of like, you believe that ice bath is helping you, but data shows that it doesn't have any positive effects on the recovery of your muscle fibers and may even have some negative effects or compression tights or things like that. And yet, if you want the best predictor of whether someone will feel better after an ice bath or a compression, you know, wearing compression tights during workout or whatever, the best thing you can do is survey their beliefs about ice baths or compression garments before they exercise. And if they believe it's going to help them, it will. And if they believe it won't, then it won't. Now, my attitude at the time was, this proves that it's all in your head and therefore it's, you know, it's complete crap. And, you know, you're just tricking yourself. So, you know, throw away the crutch, stop believing in fairy tales. I still, like, that's still my fundamental bias, is to view things that way. But as I started to look into the role of the brain and like you said, placebo effects and trying to understand a little more what it means to have a placebo effect, there's another way of looking at these things, which is like, okay, if I believe in an ice bath, I will recover more quickly than if I don't. Well, maybe that's because I believed in it, but it also still means I recovered more quickly. Like, and it has real physiological effects and certainly real performance effects. And so if you're thinking about it from a sports performance perspective, you start to say, well, hang on, maybe I shouldn't be so hasty to get rid of the ice bath or the compression garments or whatever, you know, what the billion other things that athletes turn to in search of an edge, because it works. And like, it does make them faster. It does help them recover more quickly. And then if you look at that of course led me into trying to understand the placebo effect a little more. And I mean, sometimes the placebo's effect is exactly what we sort of think of. It's just pure trickery and you're just deluding yourself. You're tricking yourself into thinking that you were better. But other times it really does produce better outcomes. And there's a famous study in the late 70s. And I'm trying to, I won't get the details right, but I will convey the gist of what it found, which was I can't remember, they were inflicting pain on people in some way, and they gave them a painkiller. And for some people it was a placebo, for some people it was real. And you know, the people who got the placebo, some of them reported really significant reductions in pain. But the catch was, they then administered an opioid blocker. It might have been naloxone. I can't remember exactly. And then they repeated the experiment. And this time, the people who had reported a placebo-induced reduction in pain no longer did, because it turned out what subsequent research has confirmed is that if you believe you're getting pain reduction, you're getting a painkiller, you end up mobilizing some of your body's own natural pain-killing functions. So you'll have endogenous opioids that are giving you the same effect as if you had just taken some morphine or whatever. And if you then take an opioid blocker like naloxone, then it blocks the effects of these things. So the placebo effect is fake, but it's triggering real effects in your body. The mere belief that you're getting a painkiller is giving you this sort of natural morphine. And so that really, those sorts of results really blew my mind and made me, you know, forced me to be a little more open to the idea that, yeah, it's not just about whether the ice bath changes the inflammation profile in your muscle fiber, because if what you think about it, what you believe, how you're thinking about this process is also going to influence what's going on physiologically in your body. It's not just like, if I'm happier, then I feel good. It's like, no. It's, things are happening in your body based on your beliefs and your mindset.
Well, it also, in some ways, what you just said confirms a lot of like Buddhist thought. That is, you know, oh, make sure to be very careful about the thoughts you let into your head, because that will affect your mood and, you know, your behavior and all sorts of things. But is there, when we're talking about something like ultra running, where people's peak performance that doesn't, a lot of the times it doesn't hit until they're in their like 40s. Is the power of mind over matter in a sport like ultra running not as applicable in a sport like, say, basketball that you mentioned earlier, or football, where an athlete's shelf life is much shorter?
Yeah, I think there's I think you could draw a graph of like sport versus how much the mental side matters, but it's different aspects of the mental side. So what I was going to say is like, yeah, basketball, it's like, no matter how much, I can't believe I'm a big guy. I can't recruit any internal, endogenous opioids that are going to make me play like a 6'8" guy. I'm just not 6'8". Like, so there's no faking it. There's some objective stuff. Now in basketball, there's still like the, like shooting streaks. It's very controversial about whether there's such a thing as a hot hand, but I think there's no denying that. Like, you look at why Shaquille O'Neal couldn't hit foul shots. Like, he could hit them in practice, right? But there's, right, there's a mental side to executing a motor pattern properly and to being relaxed enough. If you're too worried that you're going to miss that shot, you're going to move differently, and you're not going to move fluidly. You're going to miss the shot. So there is a mental side, but I think, and that the same is true. Like, I was going to say, if you compare a 100-meter sprint to an ultra marathon, 100-meter sprint is far more like, you have to have the physical tools to be a good 100-meter sprinter. You can't overcome a lack of speed by being just a really tough guy. There is a mental side in 100-meter sprinting. Like, the start is hugely mental, like getting off to the start. So there is a mental side, but the physical is a much more dominating thing. The longer you go in distance, and I think certainly once you get to the ultra marathon distance, the less stuff like VO2 max, muscle fibers, all that stuff matters. It's not that being fit isn't helpful. Of course it is. But, I've been watching lately, I'm like halfway through the world's toughest race on Amazon Prime, the Eco Challenge Fiji, which is an 11-day race with no, sleeping. It doesn't stop at night or whatever. You can just keep going straight for 11 days. And they're doing, 40K stand-up paddles and whitewater rafting and climbing and hiking and biking. And it looks really brutal. Yeah. But what we, what my wife and I, as we watch it and sort of semi-fantasize about, wouldn't that be fun? It's never like, we're not watching it and thinking, oh, I can't believe how fast those guys are going, or I can't believe how well they're biking. It's just like, I can't believe they're still moving after, all that sleep deprivation and how long they've been going. It's just miserable. It's mental, that battle. And a lot of the top competitors are, as you said, are much older. And I absolutely think that becomes a much bigger, it's much more crucial, just like how you handle it mentally, than whether you happen to have really good oxygen processing. Now, I think the one thing I'll say is I think it's the continuum. It's not like to run a good mile, you have to be this incredible physical specimen, and to be an ultra marathoner, you have to be an incredibly good mental specimen. It's like, to be a good miler, you have to have the physical tools, but you also, that mental side is absolutely part of it. It's just that the ratios are a little different. And similarly, as an ultra marathon or even as an adventure racer, you have to have the physical tools. You can't just sort of get off the couch and be good. If you're really tough, be a good ultra marathoner. So it's a mix of both. It's a question of the ratios.
When you talk about the endurance being really important, or the people who are older being very good at endurance, is that a result of training, or is that maturity or something along those lines?
That's a good question. I don't know if I know. I don't know if there's information that answers that. Like, why don't we see more amazing 25-year-old ultra marathoners? And there's been a few more lately of young ultra marathoners, but you look again at like this world's toughest race that I'm watching. It's mostly like, the 40-year-olds are the young guys. They're the young competitors. Now, is that because you get more experience with pushing your mental limits as you get older? You're 25, you do the physical stuff. You see what you can run for 10K or whatever. And by the time you're 40, it's like, or 45 or whatever, you're not going to be competitive in a 10K or even in a marathon maybe, but you can compete in these other things. I don't know. I think I wouldn't surprise me if there's a mix of both, that there's an advantage to being older in terms of the experience gained and knowing yourself, knowing your limits, knowing how to push yourself. But also there's a sort of selection process where if you're really competitive and in your 40s, ultra marathons is a place where you can still be competitive. Whereas it's much harder to be competitive with younger athletes at shorter distances or in different, or as you said, in basketball or things like that.
And I guess that makes sense. It's still, I wish there was more data on that, because it seems like there would be young 25-year-olds who have some sort of mental toughness that would be able to, that would be attracted to, you know, the grandeur of ultra marathon running or something along those lines. Sorry, go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it makes sense that there should, like, I don't think you can't have the mental toughness when you're 22 years old, right? Like there's clearly some 22-year-olds who are tough, who absolutely have the tools to do that kind of race. So the question is, why don't they? And maybe it's, so I don't know, like, if you, again, yeah, like, as you said, nice to have more data. It'd be interesting to know where the typical 45-year-old ultra marathoner comes from. Is it that they were in their 20s, they were doing, you know, marathons or 10Ks, or is it in their 20s they were smoking and you know, 40 pounds overweight and had a lifestyle epiphany? Or, like, so I don't know what the pathway to ultramarathon is, but I think that not many 22-year-olds, certainly 10 years ago, not many 22-year-olds found themselves drawn to ultramarathons. I think that there's been huge growth in ultramarathons, particularly in trail ultramarathons, and so there's more of a sort of thing now of, like, wow, it would be cool to run Western States or Ultra Trail, Du Mont Blanc, or what, or something like that. And so I think that is drawing some younger people, but I think it's there's not as much of a pathway. Like, kids in high school might run cross country, and then that leads them to running 10Ks and marathons. I'm not sure people, they even knew about ultra running, although maybe that's changing.
And something that I'm sure everybody who runs, who's listening, wants to know is what are some of the techniques that individuals can do to improve their endurance, to get over these mental barriers?
Yeah, this is where the rubber hits the road, right? And yes. This is where I'm less good at it. I'm a good asker of questions, but I'll give the best advice I can get. I think and in the book I explore a bunch of potential options, some of which are fairly wacky, like things like brain endurance training, which is this sort of computerized form of training that tries to enhance your brain's staying power. And I even try electric brain stimulation, and I've tried that again since. There are ideas for kind of short circuiting the process, but I think, pun intended, but I think ultimately what you're really looking for is, well, in the context of endurance sports, it's different if you're, you know, playing baseball and, you know, you need a different kind of mental mindset than, but for endurance sports, you're looking for confidence. You're looking for self-belief and, like, justified self-belief. You can't, you don't want to just be delusional and you know, be telling yourself, I can make the Olympics if I just try. Cause I tried that and it didn't work. But no, seriously, you're looking for so in the middle of the race, in the middle of any good race, you're going to have moments of doubt. You're going to reach a stage where you don't think you can continue at this intensity or at this pace and make it to the finish. If you don't have that, reach that moment, you're not pushing hard enough. You have to be pushing hard enough where you're like, where you're getting this overwhelming signal that it's just not possible to continue. And the question is, how are you going to answer that question? And if your sort of underlying internal monologue or level of belief is, I can't do this, I'm not good enough, I didn't train hard enough, my training didn't go well, then it's going to be super, super easy to let yourself off the hook when it gets hard. And conversely, if the sort of dominant thoughts going through your head are like, this is, you know, I can do this, I've trained for this, this is the moment I've been waiting for, you're going to be much more likely to keep pushing a little harder. And so the question is, how do you get to that state? And I think the most powerful way that I've come across, and the one that has a little bit of the scientific backing, because this is a key thing for me, it's like everyone, you know, there's a billion sports psychologists and experts and athletes who will tell you how to do that, and some of them may well be right. But it's basically, it becomes a matter of sifting through anecdotes and, like, whose anecdote is going to fit for you.
Right.
One technique that has been studied that I, with results that kind of blew my mind, is very, very simple. It's motivational self-talk. And it's basically a process of, and this is something sports psychologists have been recommending since the 70s, but ultimately what it comes down to is, first of all, you do some hard exercise and you just pay attention to the thoughts that are running through your head. Write them down afterwards so you can take a look and see what they are. And if you're like me, if you're like most people, you'll find a lot of negative thoughts in there. Like, this is too fast. I can't do this. I need to, actually, this is stupid. I don't even know why I'm doing this sport. Those are not helpful thoughts. So you want to identify the thoughts that sort of recur for you and then come up with better alternatives. Things like a, and it's different for everyone, right? Because it has to be something that doesn't, that works for you, that what may be inspirational for one person can be hopelessly cliched and hokey for someone else. So you want to find something that you can say to yourself with a straight face and that feels true. Not I'm the best in the world, but I've trained for this. I'm ready for this. This is what I'm here for. And then you have to practice it in training. You have to practice it in hard workouts so that it becomes second nature. So that when you reach those moments of uncertainty and doubt, that your natural instinct is to say, yeah, I'm ready for this. I can do this. It's hard. It's supposed to be hard. It's hard for everyone else too. So I wish it was, that was, you know, that's such a, as a science guy, I'm like, I wish it was like, you know, you hold your breath for 10 seconds and you right. do this or whatever. It's this much more wishy-washy process of trying to change your mindset. And I think to me, that's the best piece of advice I have for learning to get, just, you know, squeeze a little more out of each orange or whatever the case is to keep your finger in the flame, is you have to take the time to change it. Now, just sort of semi-connected thought is that, because I do, you know, having written the book on pushing your limits, I do get asked that question a lot. Like, so what's the practical takeaway? And motivational self-talk is the best answer I have. I will say more generally that I think just understanding a little more about the nature of your limits is helpful in a more fundamental way. Just understanding that, because for me, the implicit assumption of the sort of physiological view of limits was that if I feel like I can't go any farther, it's because my lactate levels are too high. It's because I'm not getting enough oxygen to my muscles. And when you think of it in those terms, it doesn't feel like you can negotiate with that limit. It's like, oh, well, I guess I screwed up my pacing. I've hit my physical limits. And so to understand that, even for the greatest runners, you know, running, when they're running world records, they're not running at a where it's like, oh, if they went, you know, 1 second faster, they would die. Yeah. Their bodies reach the balance where they're going as hard as they feel that they can. And that feeling is just a feeling. Now, just because it's a feeling doesn't mean it's you can't just ignore that feeling. You can't just decide, well, I'm going to run twice as fast. I'm going to run a 1 hour marathon because I don't care what I feel like. Like, the feelings are real, but it just means that when you get to that moment, let's say 2/3 of a race where you're like, I don't think I can maintain this pace, that's not objective physiology holding you back. That's your brain's interpretation of what's going on in your body. And your brain is fundamentally cautious. And so just understanding that, not that you can do anything you want if you whatever you believe you can achieve, that's not true, but you can negotiate. You can, you may be able to push a little harder. It may be that your brain is holding you back a little bit earlier than it needs to.
Well, it's interesting that you say that approach is more quote unquote wishy-washy. And I get what you mean when you say that, but it also makes sense that when we're talking about something as nebulous as belief, that there would not be any algorithm that you can use to sort of hack into, you know, these powers of endurance. And go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, just there are people trying to use algorithms. There is like electric brain stimulation, which is basically you put on a set of headphones with some electrodes and run some electricity through certain regions of your brain associated with perception of effort. And you're altering your perception of effort is fundamentally what you're trying to do, so that it feels a little easier. And it turns out your body, if it doesn't feel so hard, your body's capable of going a little harder, even if, you know, even though nothing has changed about your muscles. It's not clear whether this works. This is an area of a lot of speculation. And so I have to admit, there's like an attraction to things like that, where it's like, oh, I understand what's happening. You're changing the polarization, or the threshold, the firing threshold of the neurons. And so you're changing the signal between the part of my brain that's monitoring my body status and the part of the brain that's deciding how I feel. It all seems so much more clinical and scientific compared to like, well, change the words you're thinking. But I think ultimately, first of all, that feels a little bit like cheating to me. And it's also not clear it works, but and also is external. To me, there's less satisfaction. It's kind of like, hey, I ran faster in my 10K today because I actually only ran 9K. Well, that's not really, you weren't, it's like the shoes in the marathon. If you've changed the finish line, you haven't actually accomplished anything. Whereas to me, it's like this idea of self-talk and you know, as wishy-washy or not as it is, if this helps you go faster, that's an earned victory. And that's like something to celebrate as opposed to just like, yeah, I bought a new pair of shoes and they're faster. So now I'm faster, like by snapping my fingers.
And I think it makes sense because it's interesting when you talk about the self-talk, because after I'd run my first marathon, I didn't do as well as I wanted to. And I remember at the end of it being just going much slower than I had planned. And then when I was training for the second one, I would, you know, at any given time during my run, I would pretend to be in that state of mind of being very tired and wanting to slow down and just train to be like, okay, how would I react to this situation? That kind of visualization, that doesn't seem unscientific though. It seems like you're sort of just, you know, it's like imagining that when you shoot a basketball, it's going to go in the hoop. It sounds wishy-washy, but in your mind, you're replaying that action.
And I mean, I think it's, in a sense, sometimes when I talk about motivational self-talk, it sounds relentlessly positive that you've always got to tell yourself that life is going to be wonderful and you can do this. But in fact, like what you're talking about is really crucial, is understanding that at a certain point it's going to suck, and you need to be ready for that. You need to have rehearsed that in your mind so that when it starts sucking, you know what your response is going to be, and you accept that it's going to be negative. And this ties into then the whole sort of mindfulness aspect, the sort of non-judgmental self-awareness, where there's also some interesting research. And it's you know, it's a matter of, you can't pretend that it's not going to hurt. You can't pretend that it's not going to involve suffering, to be able to interpret that suffering as information, as, you know, not with a value of positive or negative. It's just like, this is telling me how hard I'm working. This is telling me whether my pace is sustainable, but I'm not panicking and thinking, oh, it hurts, therefore I need to stop. So, you know, I think there's a whole sort of suite of mental techniques, like you said, visualization, as well as motivational self-talk, and these sorts of things like mindfulness, which have become, you know, massively sort of commoditized and hyped and stuff. But, you know, again, it's like, it makes sense to me. I mean, it really makes sense to me that it's going to be an advantage that if you know, in the context of whether it's competitive endurance sports or life or other physical challenges, that it's when things get negative, if you can just be aware of that, and especially in endurance sports, like those negative signals are really useful. They're telling you how hard your body is working, but you don't want to then attach the sort of negative valence to them, that it's like, oh, it's bad that I'm out of breath. No. It's just telling you, it's not like if you're in the car and you see that your gas tank is one quarter full, you don't like start crying as a result of that. It's just telling you need to go to a gas station soon. Like it's information. So yeah, all that stuff makes sense to me. And yeah, I see what you, like, it's, is it scientific or not? Like, yeah, it makes sense. It fits with how we think the body and the mind work. It's hard to test in a placebo-controlled double-blinded trial. You can't have someone do positive self-talk or motivational self-talk without them knowing about it. So there are a couple studies that have done a good job trying to, you know, figure out whether it works, but it doesn't have that sort of gold standard evidence. And you know, it's tricky. Studying the mind is not like studying, you know, aspirin or something like that. It's very hard to test.
Well, but as we're wrapping up here, I wanted to ask you, what about your own personal experience writing this book? I had listened to a guy, David Goggins, who you may have heard of. He's all over social media, but he does all these, you know, intense 100-mile races. And he talked about writing his book as being, you know, a huge feat of endurance. Did you feel the same way?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. In some sense, yes, because it was a super, super long journey. Like I was emailing people in 2009, setting up interviews. I went to South Africa to do some research in 2010. I assumed the book would be out in 2012, and it didn't come out until 2018. So it was a 10-year journey, and that was, it's a long haul. At the same time, one of the reasons it took so long is that I took my time, and I was working as since I was a freelance journalist working in that area, I was sort of arranging things like, oh, I would really like to go to South Africa to meet this scientist and visit his lab. That's expensive. Maybe I can do a magazine piece on this guy, and then I'll get a bunch of research for my book, but I can also write a magazine piece. So I was doing it kind of piece by piece that way. And the big benefit of that is that I was paying my rent by doing magazine pieces as I went. So I did it in a sustainable way that I wasn't trying to, like, I have friends who've written books where they have a day job, and then they come home at night and spend 2 hours every night writing the book. And that sounds like absolute hell to me. And I 15 years ago, when I started out in journalism, I would sometimes work like that. Like, I'd be working every possible hour, hitting deadlines at 2 a.m. And I realized that's not what I wanted to do. So I, instead of like trying to maintain my day job to pay the rent and then writing my book in the evenings or the mornings or weekends, I worked 9 to 5 basically. And, you know, maybe sometimes a little later than that, and obviously, but I made writing the book my job. And so as a result, it took a long time to write the book, but it was less unpleasant than it could have been. And I had my kids. So, you know, I started working on the book like 2009. I had my kids in 2014 and 2016. And so initially I was like, if I don't finish the book before 2014, like, especially when, you know, we were deciding to have kids and then my wife was pregnant, it's like, oh man, I have to get this on the road. Once I have young kids, it's going to be super, super hard. And it did make things harder. But I didn't finish it in time. So I balanced that. And I also didn't want to be the guy who was like, you know, working 90 hours a week and trying to write the book while my kids were, you know, 1 year, you know, 1 and 3 or whatever. So it was a long journey. It wasn't, I would say it wasn't, it was actually a pleasurable journey. It's just, you know, it's a lot of work. I just sort of rambling while I'm thinking of it, going back to the very first question you asked me of like, how the hell did I end up going from physics to journalism? One of the signs was when I was doing my PhD, like famously, every PhD student in this hard scientist hates writing up their dissertation. It's like, you spend all this time doing the experiments, and now we have to write like a 200-page description of it. It's like the worst thing. And the weird thing was, when I wrote up my PhD dissertation, it's like, this is fun. This is the most fun I've had during my PhD, like trying to explain these complicated concepts and make it accessible to a non-specialist and blah. And that was, you know, I remember at the time, this was still 4 or 5 years before I became a journalist. I remember thinking, this probably is telling me something if I'm enjoying writing up my thesis more than I enjoyed doing the experiments.
Yeah, I mean, I think you definitely picked the right path, and the book speaks to that. Look, is there anything you want to plug before we go here?
No, I wish I had something to sell, but no, I guess if anyone is interested in my writing, probably the best place to find me is on Twitter at my handle Sweat Science, and that's where I, you know, anything I write about, or I'll post a link to that on Twitter.
Sweet. Alex, thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you to Alex Hutchinson, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Yammy. See you next time.